So I wanted to talk. I'm talking tonight about what is enlightenment. I'm trying to carry on our story for those of you who've been here for 5 days. We left the story. Those of you who are here, there was a shrine where the steps are. The curtains were closed, and there were all these weapons made out of tin foil, marvelously in a work period, being thrown at the seated Buddha. And the seated Buddha touching the earth to say that, you know, he's every right to gain enlightenment. So the idea was we left on a cliffhanger, and that we're about to move from that cliffhanger to the enlightenment itself. Yeah. On the last week, we had an 11-year-old on the retreat. And Janovac came into the room the other day and said, I need to rush out. James wants to know what enlightenment is. And he managed to have communicated that before lunch, I think. So our 11-year-old wanted to know what enlightenment is. So I thought perhaps I'd better say what enlightenment is, or try and say what is enlightenment. Yeah? So my title for the talk is What is Enlightenment? Yeah. And the main thing I want to say about this question, what is enlightenment? A lot of people ask it. There are books written entitled What is Enlightenment? And the thing I want to make clear from the start of is that I don't know. Yeah? I don't know what enlightenment is. And I'd say, go even further and say, you don't know what enlightenment is either. And then when I thought about that, I thought, yes, but if there is an enlightened Buddha in the room, I'll have to apologize. And say, I'm sorry, you do know what enlightenment is. But then I thought an enlightened Buddha would know what I meant, so I wouldn't need to apologize to him. Yeah? So let's start being really, really clear that I don't know what enlightenment is, and nor do you. Yeah? What I'm going to try and do is introduce one conceptual formulation of enlightenment and try and talk around what enlightenment might be. Yeah? Based partly on my own understanding of the Dharma and my own studies, and also to some extent my limited experience, yeah? And in that way try and answer the question, what is enlightenment? I mean, it's not just to be a tad more provocative, it's not just that I don't know what enlightenment is and neither do you, but actually I don't know very much about what the human mind is and neither do you. And when you think about this is really rather alarming. Everything we experience, everything we've ever experienced, every minute detail of experience that we ever have, we experience through the mind. Yeah? There's no other way of experiencing anything. There's a whole Western tradition of what exists outside of human perception. And of course, you never know. You can never know. Because human perception always biases what you think you know. In a sense, the one most important thing about human life is our mind, because all of our experience is filtered through it, and yet we know almost nothing about it. When I sit in meditation, I meditate, and I sometimes find it really mysterious what happens in my meditation. The other day I had a vision of a guinea pig. And Janovac had a vision of, you know, a white figure in a, you know, I had a vision of a guinea pig. And as I explored that sort of vision, it was very, very, you know, what's it all about, Alfie? You know, what on earth is the human mind? What do things mean? There tends to be ideas that we do know what the human mind is, but we really don't. So for instance, when I was younger, I looked at Freud and so forth. I was at art school, and Freud has all these really lovely sort of theories about the human mind, but he doesn't know either. Theories like the unconscious have become fact, but they're not. He made it up. It might be like that, but it might not be. My own experience suggests he's onto something, and he's sort of wrong. We really don't know our mind, and that's really rather alarming. Because, as I say, everything we experience through our mind, so it should really be the first thing we turn our attention to, but so often it's either a late thing we turn our attention to, and many people perhaps don't turn their attention to at all. Which, when you think of it, even just logically, it really doesn't make sense. So I don't know what enlightenment is, nor do you. I don't know really what the mind is, and frankly, nor do you. So it's good to really be clear where we're starting. So with that preamble, so enlightenment, what is it? There we are, we've got the Buddha sitting under a tree 2,500 years ago, and he gains enlightenment. It's the experience of enlightenment, it's the gaining of enlightenment that makes the Buddha a Buddha. He wasn't the Buddha before then, and most of you know this, but Buddha is a title, it means awake. It's an imperative, it doesn't even mean to be awake, it means awake. Yeah? So the Buddha awoke 2,500 years ago in an experience that in the West has become called enlightenment. More traditionally it's called nirvana. Enlightenment in a way is a bit confusing a term in a certain sort of way, but then so is nirvana actually. In some ways nirvana is more confusing, but I'll come back to that at the end of my talk. Yeah? So if you try to then say, so what happened? He's sitting under this tree. What happened? In my group, Anna has been saying, can we be a bit clearer about what happened? And you know, like, who was that great big monster running across with all those weapons? Am I to take that literally or not? What actually happened? Which is the bit that happened and which is the bit didn't happen, but it's a nice story? Yeah. I think it's a very, very good question to ask. Unfortunately, it's not one that can be answered properly. Probably, and I'm a bit of a materialist, so I have to be a bit careful, probably if you were there that night and sat quietly watching the Buddha, sitting night after night without moving under the Bodhi tree as day and night passed, probably you'd see nothing at all, apart from a man who I thought would probably be about Yonavarcha's height, approximately the same colour, sitting under a tree. Yeah, that's all you would have seen. Yeah, so you wouldn't have learnt much even from witnessing the event. Probably, it may have been much more than that. I can imagine an atmosphere, for instance, but that's another matter. So broadly speaking, people have tried to talk about what is enlightenment in two different ways. So they've tried to give, well, the Buddha himself talked in different ways, and he particularly tried to give a conceptual understanding of what enlightenment was, and sort of as the tradition went on, there was more and more images for what enlightenment was. It's tempting to think that the conceptual understanding is the real one, and the images are kind of nice, and a bit colourful around the edges. Actually, I think they're trying to do exactly the same thing, and one of the things I want to try to evoke in this talk is that concepts and images both have limitations, but in this case they're trying to point to something that we cannot know. Yeah, we cannot know. So for instance, when the Buddha himself talked about his experience under the Bodhi tree, and incidentally he knew he was enlightened, he knew he was a Buddha. In the text he goes back and sees his father and he says, I'm the Buddha. I'm not your son anymore, I'm the Buddha. Yeah, so he knew what had happened. He doesn't think, he didn't, you know, he knew, yeah, he knew. And he gave expression to his experience in an idea that's become known in the West as conditioned co-production. Conditioned co-production. And that is, if I can remember the formulation properly, this being, that becomes. On the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. On the ceasing of this, that ceases. Yeah? So it's very, very straightforward. Seems to be straightforward. This being, that arises. On the arising of this, that arises. Anyway, I won't do it again. I was amazed I could do it the first time. In a way, it's saying that actions have consequences. It's saying much, much more than that. In a sense, it should have been a whole, tonight should have been a whole talk on this one, and this major idea, it's not even an idea, it's something much more than that, this basic insight that the Buddha's translating into concepts. I find that it's one of those concepts in Buddhism, well, it's the belief in Buddhism almost, that can look simple but is really, really difficult. It's difficult to understand it intellectually, And by golly, is it difficult to make any sense of it emotionally or in any other way, yeah? So I'm not going to say much about it, actually. I'm not going to say much about it. But there is a tradition of Buddhist philosophy arising largely out of this. And it is the central Buddhist doctrine. If you want to understand Buddhist doctrine, and if you ever want to become a Buddhist, you'll need to understand Buddhist doctrine. This is the central doctrine. In some ways, this is the only doctrine. The rest of Buddhism is a practice, and sometimes a metaphor. But Buddhism is primarily something you do. It's not primarily concerned with doctrine. If there is a doctrine, this is it. Conditioned co-production. It's the only doctrine. And it informs the whole of Buddhism. To understand Buddhism at its depth, you need to understand conditioned co-production, which would be to become enlightened. To really understand that formulation, which for some reason I can't repeat, to really understand that, you'd be enlightened. Yeah. But there are also images around around the whole event. And I take the later, slightly more legendary, mythical traditions that we've been drawing on as quite, extremely intelligently illuminating what happened. Yeah? So Vidyajyoti was talking about the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree and all of Mara's hordes rushing towards him. Now that's telling you about the nature of enlightenment. That's an image for enlightenment. It's not really something before enlightenment, I don't think, personally. I think it's one of the many images for enlightenment. According to some traditions, as the Buddha sat there, he sat there for many, many days, and a great snake came up, wound himself around the meditating Buddha, and opened his hood above the Buddha's head so that when it rained, it didn't rain on the Buddha. I think that's an important image for the nature of enlightenment. It's not just a pretty picture, and depending on how you feel about snakes, it really does communicate something essential about the nature of enlightenment. And there's lots and lots of other images. In a certain sense, the image that my evening story ends with is the image of a god coming down, Brahma Sahampati, as he's called, which I always think sounds a rather comical name. A god comes down and asks the Buddha to teach all beings, teach them the Dharma. And again, that's a central part of the enlightenment experience. They appear sequentially because it's a story, and we like stories, and stories touch our heart. But they're not really sequenced, I don't think. I think what we need to imagine is the Buddha, as it were, or Siddhartha, walking along a landscape. We see him disappear into a grove of trees, and we never see him again. Or we see somebody appear, but we can see no connection between the person who walked into the trees and the person who comes out of them. There is a connection, but we won't be able to see one. And there's a space in the story. It's as if a music was to start, travel the arc of music, stop, and then start again. Yeah? And that space is the enlightenment experience. That experience informs the whole of the rest of the arc, and when the Buddha told his life story, backwards as it were, it informed the whole of his life. Yeah? So it's a space, and all the images, all the concepts, try to give us an imaginative sense of what happened when we saw this man walk behind some trees, what happened when he disappeared, and how come he appears in this completely new form, like a caterpillar reappearing as a butterfly. The other thing to say is that we're wrong to try and separate fact from archetype, from myth. In my group again, Kieran was saying, could you please tell me what actually happened? Just give me a very, very simple story. What actually happened? You can do that to some degree, but you can never really know because the stories of the Buddha's life weren't written down to much, much later. And actually, you can't separate history from mythology, from and we can't do that with ourselves. We can't do it in our own life. Our dream life betrays that. Our dream life's important. Our imagination is important. It's vital to us. Our visions are important. Even the way we understand each other has mythical, archetypal significance. We aren't just mechanical creatures. There isn't just a ghost in the machine. My mind is not just a ghost in this machine. There's something much, much more to us than our physical reality. So history is always a kind of lie, or at least very, very partial. It's only looking at a particular aspect of a particular part of material existence. Suddenly a quotation comes to my mind and I can't remember what it is, but that's just the case, yeah? So I don't think even on our own life we can separate fact from, and I won't say fiction, I'll say from myth, from poetry, from a story. So much of our life is story, self-story. We tell ourselves stories all the time. So for instance, I've been struck by the tree just outside. There's the one just as I come out from fielding. I don't know what it is. It's a tree, I know that. I'm not stupid, but I don't know what kind of tree. It's very, very beautiful. And every morning when I come out to meditation, I've been very struck by it. When we first came here, the whole place was shrouded in mist. And winter trees at this time almost seem to draw the mist into themselves and hold it, like the mist in the branches of the trees becomes a kind of nest. And I was looking at this tree yesterday and thinking, well, you could just imagine the Buddha sitting under that tree. I mean, that's what's happening. He'd be sitting under a tree a bit like that. And then you look at the tree and you try and describe it, and how a tree goes from that lovely sort of athletic trunk to these beautiful curved branches, and thinner and thinner to these tiny fronds at the end, almost becoming sky, as if the material could become immaterial. Just by looking at it, you can see that almost transmutation. And of course, there's something around leaves and oxygen, isn't it, that does that, yeah? And you can't do justice to a tree by saying it's a particular arboreal specimen or it's a bit of wood. It would be absurd to do that. To even enjoy a tree, you need to use all your imaginative faculties. Otherwise, you don't do justice to a tree. Never mind a Buddha, you don't do justice to a tree or a box of matches or a mop bucket. Because you experience it all through your mind, so everything must be mysterious because we don't know very much about our mind. Yeah. In fact, we know next to nothing. So if you imagine, for instance, here's another image that perhaps it's easy to pass over, but the Buddha sat under a tree. He didn't sit in the middle of a clearing, he sat under a tree. And according to tradition, he was born under a tree, and according to tradition, he died under twin sal trees. The Buddha spent his life with trees. He lived with trees. And the figure, if you look at, think of that tree outside, if you think of a figure sitting underneath it, cross-legged, incredibly peaceful, again, it becomes an image for the nature of enlightenment. Because a tree has got all these roots going down and down and down into the earth, into all the detritus of the earth, all the slime and feces, whatever it is that's mixed up into the earth, the dead snails, the slugs, the worms, it's all going down into that. And then it grows up out of the earth and reaches up into the sky, stretches out into the sky. And at the midpoint, you've got the Buddha sitting there, unifying both, making sense of both, exemplifying the tree. Something about the Buddha's experience must be that it reaches right down into those horrible mucky bits of our psyches. And it's always worth remembering, isn't it, that human beings are messy creatures. Never believe it if you think they're cleaned upable. They don't seem to me to be clean upable, at least certainly I'm not. The Buddha's experience reaches right down into old hatreds and so on, and right up into quite other worlds of consciousness. And the Buddha integrates both, makes sense of both, is both, yeah, just by sitting in that position. So even just that position, It might have historical significance. It's certainly got archetypal, mythic, and spiritual significance. Yeah. Check the time. Just keep an eye on the time because I tend to talk a lot. So what I'm saying is, you've got concepts, you've got images. Both of them are trying to communicate some overwhelming experience that the Buddha had, and that for us he disappears. In a very early commentary, it says, "How can you track him, the trackless one?" There's always this sense of the Buddha that he's unknowable. And he actually says in later life, you cannot know me. I am unknowable. Yeah? You cannot track me. You can't predict me. It's interesting, for instance, in later life, somebody said to him, you seem to me really rather remarkable. Are you God? And he said, no. In fact, he said it was an insult to be called God. So that wasn't a very good start. And then the person said, are you an angel? And he said, no, I'm not an angel. And then the person said, are you a human being? And he said, no, I'm not a human being. Which is really odd, because it's really, really clear from all Buddhist sutras that he was born just as we are born. He was born as a human being. But he said, no, I'm not. I presume what he means is I'm not a human being in the way that you can possibly imagine a human being. I'm so transformed, I've got a human body, but I'm so transformed that to call me a human being is to reduce me. Yeah, is to reduce me. So this person said, so, you know, what are you? And he said, I am the Buddha. Yeah, quite clear. Bhante Sangharaksha, to my own teacher, he thinks of the Buddha as being a whole new species unto themselves. I find that really, really exciting, that there's something in consciousness that can grow and develop to such a point that you become a whole new species unto yourself. Anyway, I'll let you ask people in your study groups about that. It's good to leave a trail. After the Buddha became a Buddha, he didn't need to carry on living. In the moment of enlightenment, he'd seen through the mystery of birth and death. Death had no fear to him. He'd seen through the whole thing. He'd seen through life. So he could have just sat there and died, and for him it wouldn't have mattered. Later on, Jnanavarta is going to be talking about the Parinirvana. And the thing about the Parinirvana, the Buddha's so-called death, is it's not an event for him. It's an event for everybody else, but it's not an event for the Buddha. Nothing happens. Because, in a sense, after he gained enlightenment, nothing happens. They say, don't they, or remember Simply Red saying, heaven is a place where nothing ever happens. And that's not actually true, but Buddhahood is a place where nothing ever happens. Yeah? So according to tradition, the reason the Buddha lived is out of compassion. The reason that his complete motivation for being around was to help others gain enlightenment. There was no other reason for him to live. He didn't need to live because he was frightened of dying. He didn't need to do all the things that we do to keep living, you know. He lived because, according to tradition, because he saw those around him could be helped, could gain enlightenment for themselves. He lived out of compassion, from compassion. And of course the reason why he did that is because enlightenment, to put very, very, very simply, is the experience of egolessness, of complete egolessness. Easy thing to say, but almost impossible to imagine. So some people get it completely wrong, so they think egolessness means, you know, you just sort of don't exist, so you just go and walk into a wall and knock over and, you know, do silly things, you know. But egolessness isn't like that. I don't know what egolessness is like because I'm not egoless. Yeah? Anyway, but that's the Buddha's experience. And from that place of egolessness, all that there was is compassion. In the place of me, in the place of self-vaunting, in the place of self-wanting, is just love, is just compassion. There isn't anything else. Yeah? Okay, so just as we can't really make a distinction in our own life between history and myth, we can't make that distinction certainly in the Buddha's life, when we think of our own life and when we think of the Buddha's life, we can't really make a real distinction between biography and hagiography. Yeah? It's a big word. It's the biggest word in this talk. So it's all downhill from here, folks. Yeah, so you can't really make a distinction in the Buddha's life story between biography and hagiography. Hagiography is usually a word used for the life story of saints that's embellished by myth, you know, magic events, miracles and so forth. It's called hagiography. And it tends to be a slightly pejorative term and meant to mean that we need to get rid of all this and get to the truth. I think that's not true. I think there is truth in hagiography, and we should restore it. I think there's truth in it in our own life, and there's certainly a major truth of it in the Buddha's life. So we can look at the Buddha's life as his life in northern India, 2,500 years ago, or we can look at it, I think more usefully, as a living out of an ideal universal spiritual growth. Yeah? If we look at it from that perspective, it might be useful to us, I think it is useful to us, as a kind of story of what human spiritual growth from the base up to the zenith, up to enlightenment, is. Yeah? So let me just plot that a minute, and this is also is a handy way of telling those of you who weren't here last week the story so far. Yeah? So the Buddha, Siddhartha, was born in northern India. He lived a privileged life, so it seems. There's talk of palaces, there's talk of dancing girls, who knows, yeah? Who knows? He certainly seemed to have been come from a rich enough family, which in India is really rather different. It's probably like us, it's probably about as wealthy as we are. We live like Renaissance princes compared to that time, and in fact, compared even at this moment to most of the world. But so he'd probably be a bit like us, he'd be wealthy like we are. And he seemed to have been really, really good at martial art, very, very athletic, extremely handsome apparently. What you've got there in the early stories of the Buddha is what I think of as healthy egotism. He's a healthy, egotistic young man. He probably thought a lot of himself. He could beat people at sport, he was probably very competitive. He was obviously pleasure-loving. It's really important to remember, for instance, that he's not a virgin. That the Buddha, when he became a Buddha, is not a virgin. He, according to tradition, whether it's true or not is another matter, he had a son. In some early sculptures, interestingly, they don't include images of the wife and child. So it's possible, again, even that's a later tradition, so we shouldn't get our proverbial knickers in twist about that one. He just seemed to have been a healthy young man. Played sport, had sex, enjoyed himself, yeah, had pleasure. And I think that's where we need to start. And if we're not starting there, we need to get there. Yeah, I don't mean now, necessarily. Let's keep it clean, folks. But we want to start with a basic healthy egotism, not shot through with neurotic guilt, not shot through with sex hang-ups, not shot through with all kinds of stuff, yeah? Just a healthy, slightly selfish person, yeah? Who basically likes himself best, thinks they're really good, yeah? That would be a really good place to get to for some of us, yeah? A really good place to get to. And that's where the Buddha starts, like that, yeah? In his case, he starts as a healthy, virile young man who's quite happy with that, and quite happy with that, yeah? And that's what the men need to be, and the women need to be healthy, virile young women, or whatever, you know. I won't go into the age thing, because it's a bit embarrassing for me. So then he grows up, he sees, as if for the first time, according to tradition, he goes out of the palace, he sees an old person, an ill person, and a dead person. He sees it for the first time, but it's probably more like that he sees it as if for the first time. In other words, he really sees that you will get old, that I will get old. I'm young now and da-da-da, I'm having great fun now, but it's not going to last. I will get ill, I'm healthy now, but I'm going to get ill, and I will die. Most of us do not see those things. We might see them with our eye, but we do not see them. So when this whole mythology around the three sights and eventually the four sights are about actually seeing them, not just noticing them, but knowing what they mean. Yeah? So I think this is a stage of growing up. Siddhartha starts to grow up, and that's what we need to do. We need to grow up and realize that we're going to get old, we're going to get ill, and we're going to die. And in those three things, we grow up. If, to the degree to which we cognize and know those three things to that degree and only to that degree, we actually grow up as human beings. There's lots of childish old people, and it's because they haven't got to grips with that, And by golly, they're very difficult to get to grips with. It reminded me of my own experience. When I was thinking about this talk, I was reminded of when I was very, very, very young. When I was very, very, very small child, I was a very, very happy child in the earlier part of my life. Later on, it got very, very much more difficult. And I think of my childhood as being generally a very unhappy time in my life. But the earlier time was actually very happy. And when I was young, before I went to infant school, I have three older brothers, and by this time they'd gone to senior school and got out of the way, which was good for me. And as yet, my sister, I've got a younger sister, hadn't been born. And my mother then used to, she was a housewife, and actually she wanted to be. She ended up driving coaches, but that's another matter, which she never wanted to do. But she wanted to do that. She was brought up just to look after the house, yeah. And I remember I used to follow her around the house, and we'd hoover mum and dad's room, then we'd hoover the boys' room, because my brothers were called the boys, and I was called by my Christian name. Don't know why. I somehow never became one of the boys, and I'm still not. I can explain it at a later date. I remember following her around, and we'd go to my brother, the boys' room, and then we'd go, and I'd be so happy. I'd be so, so happy just being with my mother, on my own, with my mother. And I remember one day, I remember it really, really clearly, and I must have been tiny, actually. I don't remember anything around it. But I remember one day her hoovering her room and dad's room, the big double bed and all that, hoovering this not very, very great carpet. And I remember feeling incredibly happy looking at my mother and how much love I felt for my mother. I felt it really, really strongly, an upwelling of love for my mother and how happy I was. And in that moment, and I still can't understand this now, but in that moment, I had some prefiguration that it must end, that this happiness must end. Thinking back on it, it was so old, there's very, very old memories where you think, is this a dream or a memory? Thinking back on it, I think of it that I knew that she would die one day. Or I knew that I would die. But somehow, in that incoherent way, I knew that this must end. I had this moment of intense happiness, not that I could have used those words then, and I knew it must end. And I remember weeping and weeping uncontrollably, unconsolably, that this would end. I asked my mother about it recently, and she couldn't remember anything, but probably I wept a lot in those days, and one weep is as much as another. And I sort of vaguely think I have a memory of not being able to explain what I was crying about, sobbing about. But I've remembered it very much to this day. And I think it's a little bit like, in my own way, the Buddha's experience. That somehow you're really, really happy and you know it must end. So what does that mean? Yeah? And it means growing up. It means we have to grow up. And then the Buddha left the Buddha-to-be. One always calls him the Buddha because he told the story afterwards. But then Siddhartha, the Buddha-to-be, left home. He left one night. In the early text, he just says, I realized that actually all these things were going to happen. I realized that life at home was a narrow affair. I needed to go in search for the truth. It literally doesn't say very much more than that. The later mythical accounts point to the spiritual importance of that. But they don't add historical evidence. He goes out alone, he cuts off his beautiful long black hair, he dresses as a beggar, and lives and goes forth trying to find the truth. And he has a period of aloneness where he's alone from the palace. He's alone in this incredible jungle. I mean, we just don't have jungle like it, at least not in Europe anymore. Endless, endless jungle, and you alone. I think that this is the phase of spiritual life or human life where we have to start to confront ourselves. And I think, in a sense, that that's what you've decided to do to come here. Just sitting to meditate, as the retreat goes on and as we do more meditation, you'll be confronting yourself. Because what happens when you turn off the radio, the television, put down your iPod, stop sending emails? What do you see? What do you meet? You meet your own mind. And that's what the Buddha must have meant met as he went into the forest. You have a period of aloneness where you start to confront who you really are. Yeah? And that's part of human growth. If we don't do that, we don't grow up. And of course that needs incredible courage. And whether one literally goes off on one's own is really neither here nor there. There needs to be courage in finding out, what do I really think? What are the things that I think that are just what my mother thought or my father thought? Yeah. And then he meets two teachers, and they teach him all they know about meditation. So this is a phase of what I think of receptivity. Siddhartha is exquisitely receptive. So he might have been a competitive young gun, but now he's grown up a bit and he's really, really receptive to what people around him can teach him. And he learns so quickly that his teachers offer, you know, they say, well, look, you've got it, you know, why don't you lead this, yeah? So he's grown up enough to be incredibly receptive, to actually learn. So this is a period of complete learning, yeah? And it's something that many of us in the West really need to learn. Most of us have got this pride around me, this is me, I know better, da da. Who are you to tell me? Oh, you're an authority, you're an order member, even if you're not wearing one of these funny things. Who are you? You know, what have I got to learn from you? It's just sort of pride. And to the degree to which we have that, we won't learn, and to the degree to which we won't learn, we won't grow up. To actually learn, you need to be confident in yourself. You actually need to think, yeah, I've got things to learn. But that doesn't mean to say I'm awful or bad, I just got lots to learn. There's lots to find out. Yeah? So this is a period of complete learning, of complete receptivity. And again, to make real use of being here, we need to learn from the Buddha. We need to learn from Siddhartha and try to develop this receptivity. An intelligent receptivity, because he knew that his teachers were limited. He didn't just think they were great and just completely go for it. He thought, yeah, that's great what you've taught me, and I don't think it goes far enough. So it's an intelligent, alive receptivity. Then he meditates very deeply, has these incredible meditation experiences, and this is the phase of refining consciousness. So according to tradition, he has these quite incredible meditations. And this is a phase, as I say, of refining consciousness. Of taking the whole of one's being and lifting it up to ever higher levels. Yeah? Starting with what one actually is, here and now, and lifting it up, gradually lifting up the whole of the psyche to ever and higher level. That's what I mean by refining consciousness. Sometimes people don't like this word, refining consciousness, because they're frightened, and I think in some way quite understandably, that you'll just end up as a middle class person, basically, who speaks refined, but dot, 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 dot. And Buddhism isn't trying to teach you to become middle class. It's not a middle class tradition trying to inculcate middle class standards on non-middle class people. But wherever we start, we need to refine our consciousness. Yeah? So the example that comes to mind for me about what refining really means is one of my great heroes, Cezanne, the French post-impressionist, although he's not really. Many years ago, I remember when I first met Jan of Archer, we used to go to see this Cezanne exhibition. And I used to insist that we stood in front of this particular painting for hours on end until Jan of Archer got it. We weren't going to leave until he did, but he did. Either that or he faked it. I don't think he faked it. And really, really interesting. If you go through a retrospective of Cezanne, I know quite a bit of Cezanne, he's a kind of hero of mine. And if you look at the early paintings, they're paintings about rape and murder, and they're painted really, really, really badly. Yeah? If you look at his early life drawings, they're really bad. You can look at them and think, yes, I can do better than that. because competitiveness can be healthy, you see. So you just see this really, frankly, quite crude mind picturing itself quite crudely in fantasies of sex, rape and violence. Yeah. And what you see as you go through the exhibition is the crudeness, the predictability, the egoism, the sort of obviousness of that dropping away more and more and more. Interestingly, he learned so much from Pizarro, who he said was like a father to him. He had, again, this phase of complete learning from Pizarro, who was apparently almost saint-like, which Cezanne was never like. But you know, he had this whole phase of receptivity to this older man. And what you see is these paintings ever refining, the colours becoming richer, more subtle, the architectonics of the painting more and more intelligent, the masses in the painting brilliantly organised. But by golly, if you look at him properly, he's still as tough as ever. He's still an irascible man all the way through, tough as iron. If you look at the paintings, underneath it's like they're soldered together. On the top there's this lovely patterning of colour. Underneath they're as tough as old boots. Yeah? So he doesn't leave any of that toughness. He refines that toughness, but he doesn't become a middle-class wet. He becomes refined, genuinely refined. He becomes more, not less. Yeah? And this phase of the Buddha's life of meditating is a phase of refining consciousness. And then he decides to starve himself. He decides that what his teachers have said hasn't helped, hasn't gone far enough, and traditionally there's you starve yourself. You starve yourself. And the idea was that you starve the body so as to liberate the mind. He did it apparently more than anybody had done it before. You have these rather graphic descriptions of the Buddha's buttocks, which Maitreya Raja read with great relish last week. And I had slightly queried whether we needed to hear that, but anyway. you have this period of incredible austerity, and it was a mistake. It seems that what happens is he went to the nth degree, and probably what happened is he collapsed. And he said, in the sutras, it said that he's about to die and realised that he had gone up a blind alley, that he had made a mistake, that this was failing. Yeah? And then he has this memory of the rose tree apple. He has a childhood memory of being absorbed in meditation in a much more healthy way. I won't say much about that because I haven't got time. But basically, he starves himself almost to death as a spiritual practice, realizes that was wrong. So much so wrong that he's about to die from it. Yeah. So I think of this, and this is slightly my own, well, this is my own take on it. I think of this as the stage of complete failure. Yeah? The stage of complete failure. So we've gone through all these other stages of healthy egotism, of complete learning, of refining consciousness, of courage, of aloneness, and so on. And now we come to the stage of complete, absolute failure. How I imagine it, or have been imagining it recently, is that he thinks about his life and everything he's tried to do to gain enlightenment has completely failed. The paths he learnt from these teachers haven't worked. This tried and trusted method of starving the body to release the mind has not worked. It's complete failure. And I think this may be a stage in the spiritual life. So what I mean by this is that what samsara, what ordinary life offers human beings, I think, broadly speaking, and this is something you want to discuss in your groups, I'm sure, it either offers you sex and romance, and everything that goes with that, or it offers you fame and power. And if you look at lots of myths, what you get is either sex or romance, or fame and power. You look at Shakespeare, you get the comedies, sex and romance, you get the tragedies, fame and power. Anyway, you name the myths, you see those polarities, yeah? You even see it in the attack of Mara, this sort of incredible attack of demons. There's the Buddha sitting there, and all of these horrendous looking people with flaming eyes and so forth rush at the Buddha. They represent power. They represent all those forces of power that so often older men go for, actually. A friend of mine was saying that the world is still run by old men. It's probably true, isn't it? It's run by old men. Power is very, very attractive. And Mara's hordes are power. But they're power in the world, but they're also that desire for power, for fame, for influence, for the ability to tell people off in your psyche, in my psyche. And it's those coming back because they're the one of the strongest forces in life. After that, you get Mara's daughters. They can be Mara's sons, depending which way you swing. you have all the, catch up with me, you keep up, you have the power of sex and romance, yeah? Incredibly, incredibly alluring. And so often, if you don't get one, you'll go for another. I've been listening to Wagner's Ring Cycle, and the god Wotan in it says, I used to have love, and when I had to give up love, I wanted power. And that's what happens. If you don't get one, you'll want the other. Yeah? So sex and love, fame and power. And I think that fame and power is underlined by an essential human need to be a success. Human selfhood, egotism itself, is based on a little collection of our successes. We kind of keep a little pot saying, my successes, and that's me. And if anything challenges us, challenges my successes, we find it threatening. And if anything adds to it, we find it pleasurable. Yeah? So we have this little pot of my successes. And that can be in any field, can't it? The arts, in anything. You can start to get success mixed up with everything. And it can get mixed up, often gets mixed up with spiritual life itself. So you start thinking of yourself as a successful meditator, a successful friend, successful communicator, an successful order member, a successful rebel. You can be successful in every way. Human beings need to feel a success. And you go a bit deeper in your meditation and you think, yes, success. You know, it's like cycling past somebody. You sort of think, whoop. And then, of course, the way to be even more of a success is to say, I realised that was, success, and I was getting into that. So then you get success twice. Then you can say, and then I even realised that was kind of success three times. And then you say, of course, who am I? And that gives you sex. So you just end up with pilings of success, yeah? Which, of course, means absolutely nothing, but makes you sort of feel better than you die. You've got a little pot of success, then you die, yeah? And anyway. So complete failure is really, really important, because usually what that desire for success is a thoroughly worldly desire. We want something, basically, that others can give us. We want to be called the Buddha. We don't actually want to be the Buddha. We just want everyone bowing to us, as it were, yeah? And that's all that, in a way, samsara really, at base, offers you. Either love and sex, and let's not be sniffy about that, but it doesn't solve the problems of life, it doesn't solve old age, it doesn't solve sickness, it doesn't solve death. I'm a bit of a Wagner file, and one of my favourite offers is Tristan and Isolde, which incidentally Hitler listened to 100 times, so anyway. But it's nice music, you can understand it. And it's an incredible love story, one of the greatest love stories. But you simply can't imagine Tristan and Isolde getting married and living together. It just can't happen. They just can't go and get a takeaway together. Love and sex just won't do that. Yeah? They don't answer the questions of life. Yeah? So that's, I think, the Buddha's life as our path, as humans' path, from this healthy egoism, healthy male or female egotism, all the way up to complete failure. And so I've just got a little bit of time to tell you what enlightenment is. So then he goes, he's gone through that whole path, and he's got to the place where everything he has tried has failed. Yeah, everything he's tried has failed. And I think what that means is that you just let go. And I think what happened, in my imagination, is the Buddha let go. He just stopped trying to be a success. For him, even his vision of the three sights, interestingly, when we were hearing the story, they're about him. So he's saying, I realise that I got old, that I would get old, that I would get sick, that I would die. Yeah? In that moment of complete failure, he just lets go of trying to succeed in anything. It's like your mind then says, is there another way which is not to do with me? Is there another way? And well, I think we all have moments of this, when you try this, you try that, and nothing works, and you just sort of kind of let go, and another way appears. But you can't get there with your egotism. You can't get there because it's the path is egoless. You can't become egoless with your ego. I remember on one of these, not a retreat like this, but somebody coming along to one of my groups, he was saying that one of the things that brought him to Buddhism, he'd went for a walking holiday, and it was really, really awful walking holiday. He had a really heavy pack, it rained all the time, and he was thoroughly miserable. And he said he was standing on the top of this sort of hill, and he slipped. And there was a big sort of pond at the bottom of this sort of hill, and it was completely muddy, and he slipped, and his pack was really heavy, and he just said, "I just couldn't do anything. There I was, slipping down the hill, and he couldn't do anything about it. And he just, you know, slipped into this pond. You know, and it just came up, and it apparently, as you say, came up to his midriff. And it was freezing cold. All his food, you know, it was a complete failure. And he just said, I just thought, forget it. I just can't fight against it anymore. And he said he completely relaxed, and then he said suddenly the world was beautiful. Suddenly everything shone. And he said he's never felt so happy. Suddenly everything, life comes back. It's an incredible thing about life, that to make life work, you have to completely give it away. It's the only way to make life work. And in that story, he just gives life away, and then all of life comes back. But not even all of life, more than you could have imagined comes back. But you have to give it all away, including any sense of spiritual success. So out of that opening that happens when he gives up, wisdom and compassion arises. This is a traditional account. Perfect wisdom and perfect compassion. At least that's one account. It's probably to be remembered that actually wisdom, compassion and enlightened energy arise. Sometimes we forget that, but actually enlightenment is also particularly to do with energy. So often enlightenment is just glossed as being liberation, and that is particularly liberation of energy. Enlightened compassion, enlightened wisdom, enlightened energy. So the state of enlightenment becomes an incredible state of creativity, ongoing state of creativity, endless state of creativity, and the widest possible perspective on life. Yeah, the widest possible perspective on life. Again, I had one little experience of something like this when I was ordained 16 years ago. I won't go through the whole story, but I was ordained, I had my ordination ceremony, and I had spent the last few weeks writing my own ritual to mark my ordination, which sort of referred to my whole life. And I did this ritual, and at the end of this ritual, I closed my eyes, and it felt like the world just went and turned the other way around. It felt like, in that moment, that I'd spent all my life looking down the wrong end of a telescope. And all that happened is, I turned it round. That's all that happened. And once you turn it round, everything is all right, and could never be anything but all right. It's always been all right. Everything is just as it is. Completely fabulous. You can't, isn't fabulous not the right word? Either you get it or you don't. You see things in the widest possible perspective. And enlightenment, it seems to me, is the sort of greatest experience of that, and it stays. Yeah? So let's conclude a little bit. So I've said that enlightenment is expressed as concept, and it can be expressed in images, and the concept and images are trying to point to something that we do not know. And so that any spiritual progress, any genuine spiritual progress, is a progress towards the unknown. We do not know where we're going. We have hunches, we have feelings, but we don't know. I don't know, and you don't know. We can look at the Buddha's life in terms of archetypal history, of hagiography in the positive sense, and in terms of biography, and we can look at how that represents an ideal spiritual life leading to wisdom and compassion. So I just want to finish by just saying something about particularly compassion. I was going to say something about wisdom as well, but I haven't got time. Perhaps I will. Shall I? Maybe I've got time. I try to make smaller and smaller notes, so I'll say less and less, but it never seems to work. So what happens? The Buddha sits, and you just imagine that tree outside. You can just imagine him sitting there. You imagine the stars fretting the branches, the moon shining. You imagine animals coming and going. You can imagine day coming and going, and the Buddha just sitting there. And according to tradition, he's doing the mindfulness of breathing. At least according to one tradition, he's doing the mindfulness of breathing. And so he watches the breath, just like we were today. All these 2,500 years later, he's watching the breath. He's watching the breath all night. He's watching the breath all day. He's watching the breath. And he watches it more and more and more deeply, watches it more and more closely, and he's asking himself, very, very simply, what is happening? In a sense, that is the wisdom question, is what is going on? What is really going on? What is really going on? And that's the Buddha's question, in it were. What's going on? What is happening? What is happening? And he'd go drop down into deeper and deeper levels of meditation, the breath becoming more and more and more subtle, more and more rich. Apparently great bliss arose, but he didn't get distracted by great bliss. Great visions would arise, but he didn't get distracted by great visions. He'd just carry on watching the breath. What's going on? What is this? What is happening? And you watch more and more. The greatest things happen. You get these raptures that flood through the body. And he says, that's all very well, but what is happening? What is going on? Nothing distracts him. Not pleasure. You remember, he's completely now renounced sex and romance and fame and power. And it's more subtle elements. So it's not just sex and power. It's also internal oomph that we get attracted to, and, you know, pleasure that we get addicted to. And he's not distracted by those anymore. He's just saying, what's happening? What's happening? What's happening? And what he sees that's happening is that there is change. That there's no thing happening, there is change. And there's no thing changing, there's no breath that changes, there's no person changing, there's no Buddha changing into Buddha, or Siddhartha becoming Buddha. There is just pure change. Unnameable, unspeakable, beyond words, just change. And he knows that to such a deep extent that the vision of that, the knowledge of that, floods his whole being, and that's wisdom. That there is just change, just that. There is no things, no thing continues, and yet there is continuance. Yeah? He sees the true nature of reality, which is that there is just change. On the arising of this, that arises. On the ceasing of this, that ceases. There is just change. There's no self behind change. There's nothing behind change. There's this incredible pattern of change. It's like clouds moving across the sky, just an incredible pattern that you can never name, because names only tell you this or that. To look, watch a cloud, it was to be to say, oh, it looks like a duck, or a train, or a bus. But you can't really do that, because it's constantly changing. You can't say anything about anything that's constantly changing, because words can't deal with change. They make things into things, into its. And the Buddha sees as no things. So wisdom arises, and it's like a lamp. It's like a light. That's why it's been translated as enlightenment. It's like a light. Compassion is said to be like the light of that lamp, completely inextricable with the lamp. So you can't imagine a lamp without its light. And compassion is another element in his experience. So he's all the time, he's developing this sensitivity. He's watching his sensitivity. He's not just watching the breath in a cool analytical way. He's trying to feel what's going on. Not just think what's going on, not just ask, but feel. And what he feels more and more clearly, more and more obviously, is what's going on is wanting. Subtler and subtler and subtler and subtler levels of wanting. So when he was a young man, he wanted a bride, he wanted sex, he wanted to succeed. That's carrying on all the way down into the depths of meditation, where he wants pleasure perhaps, he wants another vision, he wants the next breath, he wants something. And he sees this wanting more and more and more clearly, and then he just lets it go. Yeah? He just lets it go. He just lets go of all wanting whatsoever. Because you can imagine he's thinking, I'm really getting somewhere here. I can see more and more clearly. But then you start to think, and I'm wanting something. And I'm wanting something. I'm wanting something to happen here. I'm wanting to get enlightened. Even on our own meditation, sometimes you'll feel it's going deeper, and you'll feel yourself thinking, I want something from this. I'm going to get something here. And that must go on all the way down, all the way down. And the Buddha just thought, no, it's not going to work. I'm not going to do that. It never worked. It didn't work when I was a young man. You know, and it's not going to work now. However subtle it is, it's not going to work now. He lets go of all wanting whatsoever, and in that moment, suffering ceases for the Buddha. Suffering ceases, because he doesn't even want to live, he doesn't want to die, he doesn't want anything. Suffering ceases, and time stops. Because time, what would it be like now, here and now, if we didn't want anything at all? If we weren't waiting for me to finish, for instance, or waiting for me not to finish, whatever it is, yeah? If we didn't want anything at all, then, in a certain sense, time would stop. Just time would stop here. If we didn't think, ah, then this is going to happen, then I'm going to go to bed, then in the morning, da da da. If all that just disappeared, and here we were. Yeah? And that's what nirvana means. Nirvana means, literally, snuffing out, and it means to snuff out greed, hatred, and delusion. In the deepest possible, most subtle possible sense. So we're not talking about conscious greed. We're not talking about semi-conscious greed. We're talking about the very underlyingly, the sort of foundation patterning of our psyche. Letting go of our desire to want, letting go of our desire to hate, letting go of our ignorance about the true nature of things. When those are snuffed out, then the Buddha has gained enlightenment.